Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Sean Bythel, the owner of The Bookshop in Wigtown, Scotland. With more than a mile of shelving, real log fires in the shop and the sea lapping nearby, the shop is perfect for bookworms. His book, The Diary of a Bookseller, is soon to be a major TV series and introduced us to the joys and frustrations of life lived in books. Confessions of a Bookseller will reunite readers with the characters they've come to know and love. Also with us is Tom Mole, who's a professor of English literature and book history at the University of Edinburgh, where he runs the Centre for the History of the Book. The Secret Life of Books, Why They Mean More Than Words, is about how books transform us as individuals and how books and readers have evolved over time. And finally, on tonight's book show, Matt Tagioff, who adopted Zelda the cat in 2014. She charmed him with her weird habits and permanently spooked expression, which he couldn't resist documenting online. Curious Zelda now has over 200,000 followers across her social media accounts and has now written her first book, The Adventures of a Curious Cat, which is the ultimate self-help guide for any cat, or indeed their human. All on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sean Bythel. He's the owner of The Bookshop in Wigtown, Scotland. With more than a mile of shelving, real log fires in the shop and the sea lapping nearby, the shop is perfect for bookworms. Unfortunately, Sean also has to contend with bizarre requests. The Diary of a Bookseller, soon to be a major TV series, introduced us to the joys and frustrations of life lived in books. Confessions of a Bookseller, which is out now, will reunite readers with the characters they've come to know and love. Welcome to the book show, Sean.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So how long have you been working in or running the bookshop? When did it start for you?
I bought the shop in 2001, so that's 18 years ago. It was the bookshop had been going for a considerable time before then. I think it had been going for about 30 years before that. Mm. It's been under my jurisdiction for 18 years.
And what made you buy it?
It was some desperation, really, rather than anything else. I did a degree in law at university and decided after 4 years of that there was no way I was ever going to go into a life of working in the law. So I kind of went through my 20s doing not very great jobs, temping and working on construction sites and things. And then got to the age of 30 and thought, crikey, right, everyone else I know is sort of halfway up their career ladder, and there isn't even a ladder for me. So I came home to visit my parents and went to Wigtown, which is the nearest town. Went into the bookshop, which I used to do regularly whenever I was at home, and just chatted to the previous owner, and he was asking me what I was doing, and I told him, and he said, well, I'm about to retire, why don't you buy my shop? And I didn't have any money, and he said, don't worry about that, banks have money. So I went to the local bank, and they lent me the money, and here I am, still paying it off. But it's the best decision I ever made.
Good.
It's great. I absolutely love it.
Oh, fantastic. So 18 years, what has changed book-wise or customer-wise in 18 years, would you say?
I think customer-wise, nothing's changed in 100 years, because George Orwell wrote a book about, or an essay rather, about working in a bookshop. And I think he wrote it in 1936. And essentially, it's a litany of complaints about customers and how annoying they are. And really, in that regard, nothing's changed. But I suppose the one thing that has changed is that really everybody asks for a discount now, whereas when I bought the shop in 2001, only really trade buyers would expect a discount. Now every customer expects a discount.
How interesting. Do you think that's because it's second-hand books that people think, well, you can charge whatever you like?
Yes, and also I think new bookshops now discount everything too, but they choose the discount and how much it is and which books to discount. Whereas with second-hand books, I think because of I don't know what it's like in the rest of Europe, but all the television programs in the afternoon in the UK are about people going around antique shops and getting things for half price. There's a sort of culture of expecting secondhand things to be negotiable on price.
Yeah. And how do you decide the price? I mean, I assume some of it will be down to how many copies you get of things, how rare something might be, or how easy it is to come by. Is that the kind of main thing you look at?
There are three things you look for. There's scarcity, demand, and condition. So something might be really rare, but if nobody wants it, it's not worth anything.
Yeah.
But if it's something, there used to be sort of rules of thumb. For relatively common books, you would charge £6.50 or a third or half of the original cover price if it was something relatively recent. But £6.50 for a hardback with a dust jacket, £2.50 for a paperback, anything antiquarian, you have to do a bit of research and find out what other people are selling it for, what it's sold for at auction, and things like that. But it's kind of all gone to pot now with the internet. So it's really become a race to the bottom because everything has just become incredibly cheap. Yeah, the internet has really driven everything down in price because it's increased competition, which is great for customers, but it's really not good for the trade. And I've seen, certainly in the UK, lots of booksellers think at the start, probably when I got into the business, thinking, wow, this is great. The internet's opening up the world as a market, so we can sell anywhere. But actually, what it's done is just driven prices right down because of increased competition.
Yeah.
In the new book trade, there's also been a race to the bottom and prices coming down. And it's that, I think, I did a talk in Edinburgh in August with Tim Waterstone, who founded the bookshop chain, obviously, Waterstones. Yeah. And we were talking about this thing, the net book agreement, which is that publishers can used to have an agreement with bookshops that any new book that came out, had to be sold at the cover price for at least a year. And that got torn up, I think, in the late 80s or mid 80s, perhaps, which meant that publishers could, bookshops, new bookshops could discount heavily, which put the chains at an advantage over the independent bookshops, because chains like Waterstones with 400 shops or whatever had much more buying power. So yeah, they could discount more, and that knocked a lot of independent bookshops out of business. And I just think, I know there are some countries in the EU where that's still, the equivalent of that is still in place. But we don't have it in the UK anymore. And I think it's a real problem for publishers and for authors, because your royalty as an author isn't dependent on the cover price. It's dependent on what a bookshop sells it for.
Mm.
So if it says $16.99 on the cover and a bookshop sells it for £5, you're going to get 10% of £5, not $16.99.
Yeah.
So it's had an impact on everything, and I think it's been extremely damaging.
Mm. Yeah, there's lots of people who I know still love going into bookshops and will always buy their books in bookshops. You could say the same about clothing. I mean, all kinds of industries now where you can buy things online, often for cheaper, and that's the hardest thing to kind of combat, isn't it? If someone goes into a bookshop and thinks, oh, this is nice, I enjoy my experience, and then the friend says, oh, how much did you pay for that? Mine was only a fiver online. It's difficult not to think, maybe I might start looking into doing it online. It must be so difficult.
Yeah, I think, Amazon is fantastic if you're a consumer, and I'm always single out Amazon because that's really the biggest place. But I do think what you can't get in Amazon or online is serendipity. You don't have what you get in a bookshop, which is to walk in and come out with something you didn't know existed. If you're going to buy online, you have to know what you're looking for before you start the process. So I've now, it's not that recent, it's been going on for quite a few years now, have people coming into the shop, finding something they want, and just taking a photo of it and buying it online. Every bookseller will tell you that they've had the experience of that.
Oh, that must be really, really hard. I suppose you can't stop people from taking a photograph, can you?
Well, I suppose you probably could just say no photographs.
Yeah.
But I don't like prohibiting anybody from doing anything. I'm quite sort of liberal in that regard, but I do think that's the sort of behaviour that, once it becomes generally socially acceptable, then all of retail is in serious trouble.
Yeah, definitely. And you have, I understand, lots of people pretty much every day coming into the shop giving you loads of books for you to sell. You're not short on books, are you?
Yes, we're not short on books, but nobody gives them to us. We have to pay for them.
Oh, okay. How do you work out a price?
Just basically on previous experience, knowing, because I've, in over 18 years, I've bought and sold quite a lot. I reckon over a million books I've handled in 18 years. A lot of them just go straight into the recycling, but I kind of know what I can get for a book. And then that obviously determines my buying price.
And what kind of books would get you excited? You know, when people come in and they've got the same old books that you received the day before, or the week before, and oh yes, thank you very much. But then do people suddenly say, oh, I've got this, and you go, oh wow, that's a great one to have.
Yeah, certainly the Dan Browns and 50 Shades of Grey don't really do much
for
secondhand booksellers. I think probably the antiquarian, most secondhand book dealers will always say that the antiquarian stuff is what gets you excited. And because we're in Scotland, particularly Scottish antiquarian things, and anything with any old book, antiquarian book, with maps or botanical illustrations, things like that, they're the things that you really start to get excited about.
Mm.
But, and for me, things, antiquarian books about Scotland with illustrations, that's the sort of, that's the peak for me. That's what I get most excited about.
Yeah. And do you often get people coming into the shop asking for specific things that you don't have?
Yes. That's a big problem. And it's very, even with a stock of 100,000 books, if you're looking at the history of publishing and printing, you're talking probably hundreds of millions of books that have been published in that time. Since Gutenberg first rolled off the his Bible in, I think it was 1455. So the chances of us having something are actually pretty scarce, pretty rare. But people still come in expecting us to have everything. However obscure the book they're looking for, they expect us to have it in stock.
Mm. And have you got quite a good memory of all the books that have come and gone in your store? So if somebody comes in asking for something specific, do you always have to check on the computer, or do you often go, ah, yes, that came in a few months ago, I know where it is?
I've got usually got a fairly good idea, actually, even with 100,000 books, of what we have or what we don't have or what we have had. Things do stick in your mind, I read quite a lot, but I don't, obviously you can't read everything that comes in, but you do start to remember author names, authors who I hadn't heard of before I bought the shop and hadn't ever read.
Mm.
That you do start to build up a kind of knowledge of literature that maybe you don't know anything necessarily about, but
yeah.
But you know where they are on the shelves, and the shop's really well organized too. So if somebody comes in and mentions an author I've never heard of, I just ask what the subject is that they write about, and I can point them in the right direction because the shop's organized by subject rather than author. So if somebody's looking for a book by a mountaineer, they just need to go to the mountaineering section, and if we've got it, they'll find it there.
Yeah. And this, for your first book, The Diary of a Bookseller, I said in the introduction, soon to be a major TV series. That's exciting. Have you been involved in that?
Not in the slightest. I'm not sure it will be made into a TV series.
Oh,
but the,
really?
Yeah, I know. I did a talk last night, and this was one of the questions. The option that the rights have been optioned, and there's a Hollywood production company working on it at the moment, but they've yet to pitch it to a TV network. But I think, as far as I know, they're working on the last draft of the pilot episode, which I think they're going to pitch to Netflix. So fingers crossed, if it goes well, then yes, possibly.
Yeah, oh well, fingers crossed for that, absolutely.
Thank you.
And in terms of sort of customers with funny questions and funny things that they say, one of the ones that is mentioned on the book is, do you have a list of your books or do I just have to stare at them? Isn't that brilliant?
God, every day you get something like that, at least once every day.
Really?
But my friend Stuart, who is, we did a talk because we're in the middle of our book festival at the moment, and I was on last night, and my friend Stuart was interviewing me, and he reminded me of something from the second book. A customer phoned up, and they were looking for a book, but they didn't know the author, they didn't know the title. I mean, this happens almost every day. But their grandfather was mentioned in it at some point, and his name was like Johnny McPhee or something. And did I have the book? And so, and this was over the telephone, so I said, I'm not sure, without the author or title, I'm not sure what I can do. And he said, oh, you must be able to do something. So I said, right, so how about... would you like me to read every single book in the shop until I find your grandfather's name in one of them?
Yeah.
So, oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I think at any job where you deal with the public, especially retail, I think you do encounter people whose behaviour you almost can't quite understand.
Yes. Well, we have similar things here at the radio station, I suppose.
I can imagine.
We're chatting on the book show, so I interview about 4 or 5 authors a week, and the book show goes out twice a week. And every so often, you know, you get an email saying, you did an interview, I think it was a few months ago, and someone was talking about getting published.
And
you kind of go, that could literally be anybody.
Anyone, yeah.
Man or woman? Oh, it was a man. Okay, that helps a bit, but still no. A few months ago, you know, it's not like it's last week when it's a few months ago.
It's a bit of a sort of nebulous
exactly.
figure.
Yeah.
I think one of my least favourite things on the radio is on Radio 4 when they have any answers on, I don't know if you listen to it or know of it, but it's a sort of feedback show where people phone in response to a political debate that's gone on the night before, so they replay it, and then there's like phoning. And I cringe when I listen to it, because it's just, you get people who, they start off sounding perfectly normal and sensible, and then turn out to be like homophobic or racist, or it's just awful. And I sit there, I try and avoid listening to it, but for some reason I'm always in the van and it's on when I'm driving somewhere.
Yeah.
And it just, you sit there waiting for, right, what is this person's horrendous prejudice going to be, and how long is it going to be before you find out?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's been great to chat with you, Sean Bythel.
Thank you
ever so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Confessions of a Bookseller, and it's available to buy on our website. Thank you for joining us, Sean.
My pleasure, Hannah. Thank you.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Tom Mole. He's a professor of English literature and book history at the University of Edinburgh, where he runs the Centre for the History of the Book. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his latest book. It's called The Secret Life of Books: Why They Mean More Than Words. It's about everything that isn't just the words. It's about how books transform us as individuals. It's about how books and readers have evolved over time. And perfect for the book show. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And what a lovely idea for a book, I have to say. Where did the whole idea come from?
Well, I've long been interested in all the other things we do with books apart from read them. I'm interested in all the things that books do to us, as well as all the things that we do with them. And I think this, you know, I tell a story in the book about one of the first moments when this occurred to me, that our books are leading a double life. They're both containers of information, but they're also objects with their own life in the world. And I was an undergraduate reading George Eliot's novel Middlemarch for class when I noticed that my book had broken down. The pages had, instead of carrying on in sequence, there was a whole section of pages missing, and a section had been duplicated in place. And so that made me think, no, my book's broken down, I'm not going to be able to read it, I'm not going to be able to finish it in time for class. But it also made me think about how this actually was a kind of object, this book, one that had been made in a factory that had gone wrong in this particular case. And I think that was the first kind of inkling that books are not just tools for reading with, but are also objects with their own kind of life.
Do you think a lot of younger people may have sort of lost that, or maybe never even had it, that sort of affiliation with books and thinking of them as real special things because of having gone digital so much?
Well, I think our relationship with the materiality of the book is profoundly changed when books move onto the screen, whether that's on a tablet or a laptop or a dedicated e-reader, your relationship between the material form that the book takes and the content that the book delivers is that's drastically different. But I also think that actually even those of us who spend a lot of time with physical books often don't pay a lot of attention to them because, you know, ever since we've learned to read, we've learned to sort of look through the book rather than at it, to understand books as, you know, a set of signs to be deciphered rather than, you know, as a material object. And so I think we have to make an effort, even those of us who are quite used to using books, quite familiar with books, we have to make an effort to see the book as a thing.
Yes, I find it fascinating how different people view books. If people are members of book clubs or whatever, or just are used to passing books around their friends, some people are very protective of their books and say, please don't turn the corners over, you know, make sure you use yes. a bookmark, whereas other people are quite used to having kind of splodges in their book and it all being wrinkled and, dare I say it, even making notes on it and all kinds of things.
That's right. There's a lovely distinction that the essayist Anne Fadiman makes between two kinds of book lover. She talks about the courtly book lover and the carnal book lover. The courtly book lover, you know, wants their volumes to be pristine and beautiful and to, you know, look like they're not soiled by actual reading. And the carnal book lover is quite the opposite. They want their volumes to look like they've been read to death. They turn the corners down, they write notes in the margins, they drop crumbs between the pages, put coffee cups on the front of the book and make a coffee stain. And all of that is just, you know, a sign of their love for the book. But they're two very different kinds of ways of approaching books, aren't they?
Yes. And are you one or the other?
It depends what kind of book it is, and I think some people can move between being one and the other. Some of my books I want to keep very nice, but most of them, if they're working copies, I am happy to bend the spines and write in the margins, and that's all part of the dialogue that's going on between the reader and the book for me.
Yes, and working as a professor of English literature and obviously dealing with books on a regular basis, have you seen other people's attitudes to books change over the years?
Probably not as much as you might suspect, actually. There are some studies now that show that students, on the whole, prefer to have their textbooks in paper format rather than online. And when they do get them online, it's sometimes because they're cheaper, sometimes because they're easier to get, they can get hold of them faster. And sometimes because they perceive it to be more environmentally friendly, although whether it actually is more environmentally friendly is a hard question to answer. But if all other things being equal, lots of students actually prefer to read on paper. And there's some evidence, it's early days, but there's some evidence that they're right to prefer this because people reading on paper tend to retain a little bit more information and to be able to answer more detailed comprehension questions about what they've just read.
Yes. Gosh, do you know what? I've never even thought about the environment issue with all the things that we're talking about recently to do with changes we can make to be more environmentally friendly. I'd never thought about books.
Right. Well, that exactly makes my point, though, that we tend not to think of books as material things, you know, with a real environmental footprint. Of course, they're made from paper, which is mostly these days made from wood pulp. To some extent recycled, although a lot of the paper that makes books isn't recycled, but it may be made from sustainable sources. But we shouldn't think, you know, that if we just shift to using a Kindle or reading on our iPad or something, that, you know, we no longer have an environmental impact, an environmental footprint, because actually, of course, you know, those devices are made using natural resources. The books that we read on those devices are data that are stored in large data centers that consume huge amounts of electricity, some of which is generated by burning fossil fuels. So those kinds of e-books and e-readers also have an environmental footprint.
Mm. I find it fascinating going to, if everybody kind of got rid of books and looked at them digitally, you wouldn't be able to nose around their book collections when you went to their house, which is something I really enjoy doing.
I think
if I go to someone's house and they've got bookshelves, I normally don't ask, to be honest, and just start going, oh, interesting. Oh, yes, I've read that. And oh, what's that about? And yeah, I find that great fun.
Yeah, you can tell a lot by people's bookshelves. You can tell a lot about them. And I like to look for the book that's sort of the heart of the library, that's really the one that really shows signs of having been read a lot. And I think you can tell, once you've found that book, you can tell a lot about the person whose library you're looking at.
And how they organise their books as well, if at all. I mean, some people wouldn't, obviously, but mine, I'm probably quite sort of over the top with mine. So my shelves are all different subjects. So I have a shelf of hardback autobiographies, a shelf of paperback autobiographies. Then I've got one for cats, one for home and garden, one for travel, one for... So yes, mine are all in subject matter, which makes them really easy to find.
But then it's really interesting that you've had to separate hardback from paperback biographies.
Yes, I've got a lot.
And that's something about the physical form of the book, the way that the physical form of the book asserts itself when you're trying to arrange books on the shelves. I know I have this problem when I was trying to put all of my books on the shelves in my flat when I moved to Edinburgh a few years ago, that you would get, you know, you'd think, okay, I've got all of my biographies here and I'm going to put them on this shelf, and then you'd get halfway along the shelf and you'd find one that was too tall and didn't fit.
Yes.
So then, you know, am I going to move the biography shelf and put it on a different shelf, or am I going to just have like an oversized biography, you know, subset somewhere else? And this is, you know, this reminds us that books are, you know, not just vehicles for text, but have their own material existence.
Mm. Oh, yes. It's a big dilemma when that happens, because you think, shall I put it on its side? And then, no, it won't look good on its side. So you have to pick a whole new shelf. Or if it doesn't fit any of the shelves, you have to buy a new cabinet. So do you have your books organized at home?
Yes, I do, in a slightly eccentric way, but a way that's supposed to help me find what I'm looking for.
Yeah, now you need to share.
So I have them, I have poetry separated from fiction, separated from everything else, and then I have them kind of roughly chronologically, because I have a lot of books, chronologically by when they were written rather than when they were published, because I have a lot of 19th and 18th century books, and then I have them grouped by author within that sort of roughly within each century. So it's not a perfect arrangement, but it at least gives you some idea where something should be.
Yeah.
But I also have the perennial problem of university professors, which is that I also have some bookshelves in my office. And the result of this is that without fail, any book you're looking for is always in the place where you're not. If I'm at work, they're always at home. If I'm at home, they're always at work.
Yes, absolutely. Two different collections.
It's a problem.
Yeah. There was a photo I saw recently, which if you haven't seen already, I urge you to have a look. It was Ben Fogel, and he put up a picture of his bookshelves in his house, and it was one of the most beautiful collections of books I've ever seen. And he's got it all arranged in colour, so the colour of the bind of the book. And how he finds things, I've no idea, because if you've got it organised how you and I have got it organised, then that would be a nightmare to find things. But it looked absolutely stunning. It looked like a kind of rainbow of colour. It was really, really beautiful. And I went home and I tried to convince my husband for us to do the same thing, but he was having none of it.
It's interesting. Sometimes you do remember a particular book and you might not remember the name of the author, but you might remember what it looks like. And I'm really interested in how those physical cues that we get from books help us to remember things about books. You know, you often, if you're thinking about a particular quotation or something like that, sometimes you can't quite remember the words, but you can remember that it fell at the bottom of a left-hand page, you know, or the end of a chapter or something like that. And in that way, the book, the physical form of the book, can be helping you to absorb the information that you're reading in the book.
Yes, that's one reason why it's,
that's one reason why it's easier to find things in your own copy, because if it's a passage you've gone back to repeatedly or a poem in an anthology that you've read a lot, the book falls open at the place where you've been putting stress on the spine. So that's an interesting way in which the physical form of the book is kind of helping us to process the information it contains.
Yeah, and very true if you're talking about plays, if you're trying to learn lines for a play, which I'm doing currently, actually, and you part of the process of kind of it going in often for me is remembering where it is on the page. You know, if, right. If you've got to remember a line and you know it's the last line on the page, that can sometimes help to remember what it is, specifically when it's at the end of a page or beginning of the page. Often that help relating to that can often help you to remember what the words are.
Yes, I think that's right. And, you know, that sense of sort of how far through the book you are as well, that you feel in your fingers while you're reading a paper book. And, you know, the Kindle tries to give you a version of this by telling you what percentage of the book you've read and what percentage is still to go. But you don't get it in the same tactile way that you do with a paper book, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. And I have to ask you about that you run at the university, the Centre for the History of the Book. What is that?
Yes. Well, so it's a research centre that is interested in all kinds of ways in which books function as material objects, the way that they're produced, distributed, received, collected, valued, circulated, across a long historical range. So we run a master's degree in book history, where we have students who are interested in all kinds of things, from medieval manuscripts right up through to 20th century fine press books, mass market paperbacks, and even e-books and e-readers.
Fantastic. Sounds like a great place to be. And do students like going there?
They certainly do, yes. Yeah, we've got a really terrific group of students who've just started their degree a couple of weeks ago, and I'm really enjoying getting to know them and learning about all the different things that they're interested in.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Secret Life of Books, it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Tom Mole, who we've been chatting to today. Tom, thanks very much for joining us. Great to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Matt Tagioff, who adopted a cat called Zelda in 2014 following an intense staring match at the Mayhew Rescue Shelter in London. She charmed him with her weird habits and permanently spooked expression, which he couldn't resist documenting online. With her signature wide-eyed look and bizarre poetry, Zelda continues to delight her growing number of followers. Curious Zelda has over 140,000 followers on Twitter and over 200,000 across all social media accounts. She's now written her first book. It's called The Adventures of a Curious Cat, and it's the ultimate self-help guide for any cat, or indeed their human. Welcome to the book show, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And I love the look of Zelda. I'm a real cat lover myself, and she just looks delightful.
She's not bad, is she? Yeah, I do sometimes just, I mean, she's actually here right now, staring back at me, and I'm still not over the fact that this cat lives with me, this permanently startled being who's Aww. Just.
You got Zelda in 2014. Had you had a cat beforehand?
I hadn't. She was my very first. I had wanted a cat from the time I was a kid, really. And so growing up, my my parents kind of got every animal other than a cat. So at one point I had geese, I had rats, I had a tortoise, I had quails, all in this tiny garden in London. And I always really just wanted a cat. So one day a friend of mine had gone to the Mayhew and just told me about it being just a lovely thing to do. Was just, I guess, her life had kind of changed for the better having a cat. And I took the plunge.
So you were sort of attracted by her eyes, weren't you? She's got really staring eyes.
She stares into your soul. Yeah, I couldn't help but notice her eyes. And that's the first thing they told me about her, that I shouldn't be put off by her spooked expression. So naturally I was curious to find out more.
So is she a kind of scared cat? Because as you say, she looks like she could be quite alarmed. And normally when cats have that, because I've got a cat and have had lots of cats, and if their eyes go really big, it often means that they're angry or they're disturbed. But I'm hoping that's not a permanent case with Zelda.
She hasn't. No, it's not permanent. She hasn't got any anger in her at all. She's skittish, definitely. I think she's just really sensitive about her surroundings. Rather than being scared, it's just that she gets overwhelmed by everything. I mean, she could just be looking at she could just be looking at a photo frame, or just a crack on the wall, and be staring right past you, and you'll think she's seen a ghost, but she's just really, really interested in the wall.
Oh, so what's your kind of daily life like with Zelda?
Well, no day is the same. No 2 days are the same, but I would say there's never a dull moment. She's just really edgy and unpredictable. She tends to follow us around the house. And one time she could be really sweet and just be brushing up against our legs, trying to sort of climb us. Another time she might just be stalking us. She'll sort of just have her head peeping out around the door frame, and you're kind of like, Zelda, what's up? And she'll kind of be asking the same. So there's a lot of awkward moments, really.
But she enjoys company, does she? She likes to be with you a lot.
She's always with us. I mean, she's literally sat here on the desk next to me. She is staring at me. You're probably wondering why she's not doing the interview.
Well, if she does want to say anything at any point, that's totally fine. So why did you decide, or why did she decide to put the book together?
She took the bold decision after she was getting quite a lot of lovely comments on social media, really. And it just happened naturally. It was never something that, we intended to do from the start. But certainly she just had a lot of people sort of asking to put her tweets and more in a book. And just after a while, a few publishers got in touch and started asking if she'd be interested, if she'd have the spare time to put a book together. So after careful consideration, she picked up a pen in her mouth and got going.
So do you think she quite likes being a social media star? Has she got a bit more of a strut about her these days?
Oh, yeah, we have to treat her differently now. roll out the red carpet for her to scratch on her way to dinner. it's funny because we do feel very lucky to be employed by her. But at the same time, she is our cat, and so she's always just been our funny sweet little cat. She's so affectionate that it's quite easy to forget that actually she's got a real ego behind it all, and that she's an author now.
She writes poems, I understand.
Oh, she's such a poet. Who could blame her? I mean, she's got so much artistic inspiration from various furniture lying around the house.
So what's her favourite item of furniture?
Well, she's really into the piano stool at the moment.
Okay.
She's piano stools, ottomans. Kitchen chairs, quite good. She's on the speaker at the moment. So she could sort of be putting one together about that as well.
So does she scratch the furniture like a lot of cats, or does she just like sitting on it?
Well, I don't know if she scratches it like other cats. I mean, she's sort of got her own little way where she'll, you know, it almost looks like she's in a fight with it. You know, all furniture is kind of alive to her. But yeah, she definitely leaves her mark. I just like to think that it's sort of all deliberate and her way of bonding with it rather than, you know, actually just racking up our bills.
Yeah. And some of the subjects involved in the book, one of them I have to ask you about, dating. Does she date then?
Oh, Zelda dates. I mean, she got into the dating game inadvertently. You know, I don't want to give away too much in the book, but she definitely had a different intention and suddenly found herself speaking to prospective daters. But yeah, the book follows her dating journey, and it does get quite exciting.
and even politics comes into the book.
Absolutely. I mean, she does seek a bigger influence on society. You know, she does assemble a very important meeting in the living room to address the various items of furniture in the room. And it's
do you have your own little Brexit going on in your house then?
I mean, she doesn't really observe Brexit, but there's a lot of we usually ask if Zelda's in or out with the you know, with the sock drawer or the shoe box. Yeah.
Very good. And what about cooking? What kind of food does she like?
Oh, she's really, really good at baking at the moment. Particularly good at she makes a great loaf of bread.
Really?
I've actually she actually put the recipe in the book, you know, step by step process so other cats can also bake. It's really, really brilliant. I mean, we're not really allowed to taste any of it, but she is essentially the ingredients.
She's a clever cat.
She's so clever.
So when you got her in 2014, how old was she? Do you know how old she is now?
We don't know how old she was. We were told between sort of 2 and 3 at the time. Okay. So she must be around 8.
Oh, lovely.
Probably been saying for the past 5 years, but yeah, she's timeless for me.
Great stuff. So how, obviously she does her Twitter account, but how do you find time to kind of assist her? Presumably you have a normal job as well.
Well, yeah, my normal job of sort of feeding and brushing her does take up a bit of time. But yeah, I do find time to also help her with Twitter. I think, to be honest, it's something that I just wanted to do. It's something that I really enjoy. And I just started as a you know, as I work in customer service, it's always been a really fun, creative thing for me to do. I only did it because it's a pleasure, and I just enjoy seeing, you know, the people following Curious Zelda reply with amazing poems and fan art, and it just sort of keeps it really, really fun.
Yeah. Great stuff. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called The Adventures of a Curious Cat, and it's by Curious Zelda. We've been speaking to one of Curious Zelda's employees, Matt Tagioff. Matt, thank you so much for joining us, and give our love to Zelda.
I will, thanks.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalog of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.